Okay, so this is radio, right? You can't see me.
No. And you can come on video. I'm on video if you want to go. Don't.
Well, it's a, I mean, it's a, I understand it's a Zoom call, so I'm just on Zoom.
Yeah. Yeah, you're live on radio just with audio, though.
Okay, yeah, I could see you with your, what is that, TC?
Right on. Well, I'm in Minneapolis. The Red Sox fan, we don't want to face the Twins this year in the playoffs, okay?
Well, you probably would want to face the Red Sox.
True.
pretty much beyond awful.
Yeah, it's really something.
Once I got rid of Mookie Betts, that was pretty much, you could see that.
Yeah.
Fantastic play. Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah. Annie, are you going to come on video and give me a 1 or 2 minute countdown at the end? Okay, so what do you want me to go sign off? 728? I think we lose our call at 728. Yeah, I'll keep an eye on the time. We'll make it work. It's vibrating. It's all fun. Are you solo there, Annie, or is Josh with you? Very good. Thanks, Annie. Let go ahead. Give us an intro. We're ready.
Are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie. Tonight on Right on Radio, David Fettig does a special double feature interviewing two authors back to back. First, wow. He talks to Paul Starobin, author of A Most Wicked Conspiracy, The Last Great Swindle of the Gilded Age, a tale about greed, power, and politics during the Nome Gold Rush in Alaska at the turn of the 20th century. Starobin is the author of many books, including Madness Rules the Hour, Charleston, 1860, and The Mania for War. He has published extensively, including in The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, The New Republic, and The Washington Post, among others. Then, David interviews Richard Terrell, author of What Falls Away Is Always, Poems and Conversations, published by Holy Cow Press in Duluth. Terrell is the author of 5 previous books, including the Minnesota Book Award-winning poetry collection, Coming Late to Rachmaninoff. Terrell is the recipient of numerous fellowships, and he makes his home in Minneapolis. All this and more, so stay tuned to Write on Radio.
Annie, are we a go?
Yeah, you're a go.
Thank you. Welcome, Paul. Paul, did we pronounce your last name correctly?
Starobin, close enough.
Starobin, welcome. So glad to have you here tonight on this history-making night when I have 2 guests in a row. Very exciting. Yeah, isn't that something? So, Paul, it's a fascinating book. I loved it for a lot of reasons, and I'll explain as we go on. But the name of the book is A Most Wicked Conspiracy, The Last Great Swindle of the Gilded Age. I think before we talk in particular about the book, we should set our listeners up for what you've done, the story you've told, broadly speaking. How about that? Tell us about the gold rush, this particular one in Nome, the broad parameters, and then we'll dive into more of the details.
Sure. Well, we're talking now about the end of the 19th century. In 1898, gold is discovered in what is later called Nome, Alaska, right off of the Bering Sea, which is kind of important because it meant that people could get there much easier than you could get to other places where it was gold. Remember the Klondike? It was a few years before. It was, people literally you know, die trying to make it to Klondike. Yeah, this is different. And the richest gold vein was found in a place called Anvil Creek. Yeah. And it turned out that the original finders were aliens. In other words, not at that point American citizens. And that later became very controversial. But in any case, as word got out, big gold rush. So the original finding, 1898, 1899, you see a lot of people trickle in. And then really it's the year 1900, which is at the heart of my tale. At one point you had 20,000 people working the beach in Nome. It was just amazing. And there was literally gold, you know, in the sands, you know, these ruby colored sands. And then nobody had ever heard of that before. They called it stardust, you know? I mean, this is crazy. So people came up, you know, they went over the rails from, you know, from the St. Paul. They could go by the Great Northern, James J. Hill's Railroad. They got to Seattle. They got on one of these ferries, you know, overloaded. People are, you know, just, you know, puking the entire way, eating horrible food and so forth. But then finally, for a couple of weeks, they reach Alaska and they're on the Golden Sands. So as you can imagine, lots of tricksters, you know, some people are willing to roll up their sleeves and get the gold in the honest way, stake their claims. Others, you know, lawyers and all kinds of people connive basically to, you know, to cheat the original finders out of the gold. And that's really where my story focuses on. That's the most wicked conspiracy, this to kind of, you know, swindle people out of their gold.
That's a great setup. It's just so amazing to think about, and some of the pictures that you have in the book are just sort of mind-boggling to think about. But I get it. Instant wealth, gold lying on the beach. It sounds hard to resist. And in many respects, your book's a bit of a legal thriller. And so before we, again, one more time, one more preface question before we step into the story proper, this is a time before Alaska's a state. It feels like a free-for-all in terms of any sort of legal system. You use the term frontier law. What should we know about the state of the state at that time and how something like we're going to talk about could even happen?
Yeah, I mean, almost no law really in Alaska at that time. It was a territory. So yes, it's the property of the federal government. Remember, you know, nobody really cared about Alaska so much until they found gold. I mean, you know, we, the United States, purchased it from Russia after the Civil War. And, you know, it kind of lay there as a big ice box. People thought that we got a horrible deal. Then we discovered gold. So, you know, mining camps have their own laws, you know. Both the real law, mining communities can make law, and sort of, you know, the law as it actually operates. So the jumpers, for example, a guy who tries to take a claim from somebody else, you know, there might be a jury of his peers. If they think that he's really jumped it, they could do everything including, you know, string him up. I mean, that's that kind of stuff happen. Yeah. Or, you know, beat him up, warn him off. Everyone has guns. I mean, it's essentially an anarchic type situation. And I think the important point here is that Congress is aware of this and wants to bring some legal order to Alaska once the gold rush begins. And in so doing, provides for a judge, a federal district judge, to be appointed to oversee what is essentially the gold district and to oversee disputed claims, of which there are many, because after all, you can't have just a, you know, mining camp justice. These need to be brought through the courts. In some cases, you know, maybe the jumper wasn't really a jumper. He really had an honest claim. But, you know, I don't know how far you want me to go with it, but basically, well, you know, who is introduced is sort of our main character, a Republican boss, and he becomes kind of the arch, you know, conniver to try to take advantage of this situation.
Perfect. Perfect segue. Exactly where I want to go next. Let's talk about Alexander Mackenzie and why I love this story even more for just what it is, a great insight into a fascinating period of American history. But I'm from Bismarck, North Dakota. There's a town just outside of Bismarck named Mackenzie, and we have a Mackenzie Hotel, and it's a well-known name. And I did not realize the man was such a shyster, and I think we can say shyster on the radio. But boy, it was really fun to read this and get the local history. So how does a guy named Alexander Mackenzie from the mean streets of Bismarck, North Dakota,
Yeah.
Fall into this position. It's an amazing story.
Yeah. Well, Big Alex is, you know, a former frontier sheriff from Bismarck. I spent some time in Bismarck researching the story. So, you know, he's very comfortable in places like Alaska because, you know, he knows how to bring, you know, a certain rough justice to the situation. But he rises way beyond that. By the time we meet him really in 1900, he's beyond being, you know, a sheriff. He's a Republican Party boss at a time when the bosses in many ways really run the political system in America. This is before the people elected senators, U.S. senators. So state legislatures made that choice. A political boss could essentially control blocks of votes in the legislatures. So Alexander McKenzie, like, was one of these guys. So he got it in his head that he could fix things in the Congress. Initially, he wanted to get a law passed that would retroactively, in effect, put these disputed claims in Alaska in his hands. That failed. I mean, people were on to him. But he did get his judge, his sort of pocket judge, this kind of alcoholic, you know, never had done particularly anything well in life, judge Arthur Noyes, appointed. You know, McKinley, the president, signed off on it, the Republicans in the Senate, and bang, you know, he had his judge, and the whole passel of them, you know, went to Nome, Alaska, and the whole idea was that McKenzie was going to get him appointed, get himself appointed receiver as a kind of custodian of these assets and fix it so that the gold would flow into his hands. That was the caper.
Yeah, really stunning. And, you know, we think about corruption today and, you know, you think, boy, it just can't be worse than it is today. My goodness, a layer upon layer of corruption there. And we should remind our listeners, too, right, Paul, that this was a time when state legislatures appointed senators. So if you had your hands in the state legislature, you could get your hands into a senator or on his back and shoulders, and you can
pretty
much set up your influence, right?
Yeah, the senators really owed their careers, their time in office, their office, to bosses like McKenzie.
Yeah.
And, you know, the situation in North Dakota is actually interesting. I don't know, you know, for Bismarck. I mean, there was an anti-McKenzie faction, if you kind of want to get into it. And Big Alex worked hand in glove with J.J. Hill, the railroad baron.
Yeah.
Actually, Big Alex, as they called him, or Alexander the Great of the North, as he was sometimes called. Yeah, he worked out of the Merchants Hotel in St. Paul. Yeah. I don't know what, you know, the Merchants, I couldn't, you know, I looked for it on the map when I was in St. Paul. It's a different building now. You can't really get the feeling for that, but I know exactly where it is, right on the river there. You know, it was a place where, you know, traveling salesmen, card sharks, you know, all kinds of people hung out. And he had a room they called the Throne Room. And legislators like from Bismarck would make their pilgrimage to see Alex to ask him for a favor or something. He would hand out railroad passes. I mean, he had all kinds of, you know, inducements to the legislature. So some people went entirely with him and got, you know, what they could get. Others really were bitterly opposed to him. But he had enough sway, you know, basically to at least get his foot in Alaska and try to do, you know, this swindle.
Right. I want to remind our readers, we are, believe it or not, almost halfway through our conversation.
Oh, no.
I know, it's amazing. We need another hour, Annie, for our show. With Paul Starobin, the author of A Most Wicked Conspiracy, The Last Great Swindle of the Gilded Age. Fascinating look at a wild time in American history. So Big Alex wasn't a terribly bright guy, right? In terms of book learning.
No. I would say in terms of book learning, that's, in fact, he was semi-literate when it came to writing like a business letter. I mean, I went into the Bismarck library. I mean, his, you know, the misspell, I mean, he, you know, he spelled like instead of where, you know, W-H-E-R-E, it might be, you know, W-E-R-E or something like that. But, right. but hey, no. This guy is incredibly shrewd. And he has a good psychological read on people. He knows how to manipulate them. Also, he had a lot of female admirers. So he had a way. He knew how to work a room. He wasn't the guy who was going to make a speech. but he could read the room. So yeah, definitely not an intellectual, no evidence he ever read a book in his entire life, but you know, he operated on the ground, and he was also, to give him his due, fearless. You know, once the miners got onto him in Alaska, his life was in danger, and he walked into a crowd, a mob. He could have easily have been, you know, killed, and he had no fear. You know, as a former sheriff, he was a big guy, a really big guy, physically imposing. So, you know, you got to kind of give him that, at least.
And I'll give you this, Paul. Those scenes that you described were cinematic and very dramatic with him, almost one man against a mob.
Yeah.
And, if he were almost any man but himself, but the man he was, it seems like he was a sure goner and he'd have been strung up like some other.
Yeah, miners are, I mean, this is like tough people, tough guys, not all guys, mostly guys. And, you know, they could fight with their hands, they had guns. I mean, they weren't going to give up, you know, their gold easily. And what's also interesting is they became politically organized. You know, this was the era of populism. The sort of the common man, the common worker, was asserting his rights against these, you know, barons of the Gilded Age, and people like J.J. Hill, the railroad baron. So Mackenzie was also seen in those terms. He was, you know, Alaska was a place where the common guy sweating it out, you know, in some factory, some office, he could go to Alaska and, you know, every man is a king, right? I mean, he could have his gold, he could buy his beer with his gold, he could go home. Yeah. There were a lot of ladies of the evening there. He could spend an evening in that way. There were casinos. I mean, Wyatt Earp was up there. So, you know, yeah, you could kind of have, it was an adventure, you know, it wasn't just, it was, you know, people, you know, they love that kind of thing, right? California,
right?
You know, the 49ers, all the people who went there. It was exciting.
Yeah. I have to say that was a fascinating part of the book, and the story was how a town, a little economy, sprung up so quickly. Everyone just sort of plays the right role. It's just an amazing story. I want to jump to President McKinley. You mentioned earlier the fact that this goes all the way up to the White House. You know, maybe shouldn't surprise me, or shouldn't have surprised me, given our discussion about corruption everywhere. Not that McKinley was corrupt in this regard, but it is fascinating that, again, Big Alex from Bismarck has some sort of reach out connection to the president. So this could take a while. You can go wherever you want with this, but tell us about the connection to President McKinley, please.
Yeah. Well, McKinley needed people like Big Alex because, you know, in a national election, you need people who can help you, you know, win the states and the electoral college system. So Big Alex and J.J. Hill, you know, combined to help McKinley win in 1896. You know, he won North Dakota and he won Minnesota. So, you know, in that sense, McKinley was a very traditional politician, even an Ohio governor. He's in the White House. So naturally, he's going to reward the people who helped him. With the question of this judge, which is really kind of critical to McKinley's role, you know, it's really very difficult to say, you know, what he, McKinley, thought. You know, McKinley never wrote anything down on paper. He disclosed very little, unlike the guy who succeeded him, Teddy Roosevelt. He disclosed everything, right? This is not McKinley's way. He's got a cigar in his mouth, and there's not a lot of leaking that goes on. But I have to believe, I mean, why would Big Alex from North Dakota want a judge, you know, to go to Alaska to help him out? I mean, you know, Alaska had gold. I don't, you know, McKinley had to realize that there was something going on there.
Sure.
And then later, you know, to jump ahead, but, you know, Big Alex, he does get nailed. He gets caught. The judges in San Francisco who oversee, you know, the corrupt judge in Alaska, they punish McKenzie, but they put him in jail for contempt of court because he's defied their orders, you know, to stop looting the gold. And McKinley steps in, and really on a pretext that McKenzie's suffering from bad health, a bad heart, he commutes McKenzie's sentence, he gets him out of jail. And of course, you know, Big Alex lives, you know, like for decades afterwards. I mean, that was, you know, that was the convenient fiction, you know, show mercy on the, you know, the ailing prisoner. So McKinley is sort of up to it in his ear, to his ears, but, you know, he's thinking about his own reelection in 1900, which, you know, and then of course he gets assassinated. It's you know, right. terrible in Buffalo after all of that. But, you know, he was a part of the system. I think you have to think of McKinley as being part of this system, if not personally, you know, corrupt. I don't think he was a particularly wealthy man, for example.
Right, right, right. And this was a big story at the time, too. What was going on? People were really tracking this whole thing with McKinsey and the big swindle and McKinley's role, taking the big train ride out west.
Well, you can imagine because of the gold and everybody was, you know, so interested in it that the idea that, you know, one guy was basically trying to rip off, you know, the miners was a great story. And then the fact that he had all these political connections, you know, to Washington, to top people in Washington, that made it even juicier. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some years now, you had a kind of a partisan press. So, you know, the populists, the people who were, you know, not identified with the Republican Party, they had a natural interest in promoting it as well. So, yeah, it became a big scandal. San Francisco had a very, you know, real muckraking press at that time. Mark Twain, you know, came out of there writing for So they kind of they fanned those flames and became something of a national scandal. And McKinsey became, I call it the last great swindle, because he kind of became a symbol of the Gilded Age that was, you know, coming to an end, but still, you know, just how corrupt things could be and how difficult it was just for the ordinary guy, in this case, the ordinary miner, to, you know, to get ahead.
Yeah, and also you have Teddy Roosevelt coming in and, you know, at least nominally cleaning things up a little bit in this regard.
He got rid of the judge, you know, that was long overdue. Yeah. But he didn't get rid of Big Alex. Alex was still the Republican National Committee man from North Dakota. I mean, Teddy also wanted to get elected to office, so, and he did, of course. So he found Big Alex. I mean, a guy like Big Alex is, you know, is useful to people.
That's right. Say, Paul, how did you stumble on this story?
So I was really interested in something to do with gold, because I just thought that would be interesting, fun, kind of, an, you know, so much adventure attached to that. And I thought initially of California, but quickly discovered, I mean, the 49ers, that story has been done so well. And, it's just one of those things, you know, Alaska, okay, you know, I didn't know a lot about Alaska. I'm from Massachusetts, never been to Alaska. Right. And sometimes, you know, the things clicked a bit, I guess, when I came across the Big Alex thread. And so, you know, it kind of just sucks you in, I guess, as much as anything else.
Right, right, right. I was impressed. I've done some writing over my career, nonfiction stuff, but you're, I don't know if you have any background in legal studies or whatnot, but boy, you've had a lot to navigate there in terms of research and pulling this story together.
Is that a challenge? Well, thank you. Yes, it's a challenge. You know, initially I thought it would be helpful that I have a background in business journalism. I started out that way at a small newspaper in Massachusetts, the Lowell Sun. I covered business. And then for 4 years, I was the bureau chief for Business Week in Moscow. That was the early Putin era. That was
really,
yeah, there was a certain kind of business there as well.
Yeah.
So you know, I knew that that could be of some help. The legal stuff, though, you know, it was more just things I had to learn on my own. And, you know, the challenge of that kind of writing is just knowing what you have to say, but, you know, but all the sort of, you know, trails that you really don't need to go down.
Right, right, right.
To keep it moving, you know, and not to get trapped by all that. So you're kind of a translator, you know, you read up on the law and the legal cases and you try to make it, readable and lively, you know, for the people who are going to pick up the book.
Yeah. Fascinating. I enjoyed the heck out of it. We have been talking with, I'm going to get one more question out of you, Paul. Paul Spearman, author of A Most Wicked Conspiracy, The Last Great Swindle of the Gilded Age. Take a look at it, my friends out there. And, Paul, I'm going to take a look at your other books. The one on the onset of the Civil War strikes me as particularly fascinating. But without looking back, let's look forward. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, the one thing I would like to do, I haven't committed to it yet, is something to do with the kind of founding years of the American republic, because I feel right now we're in this time. I mean, it relates to Trump, but it's not just Trump, where, you know, we're looking at sort of the building, you know, the institutions of the country, you know, what's in the Constitution. I mean, all that kind of stuff. And so I'm doing a lot of reading about that period. If I can find a good story there, then that would be fun. That would be fun for me.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I have a good friend who likes to read history, but he loves these kind of books, these sort of special, almost sidebar stories at the time that were huge, but are mostly forgotten, if you will.
Yeah.
Great fun and a lot of insight. So once again, ladies and gentlemen of Right on Radio World, that was Paul Sterobin, author of A Most Wicked Conspiracy, The Last Great Swindle of the Gilded Age. Paul, it's been a real treat speaking with you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Great fun. We hope to have you back sometime with your new book.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Care. And back to you, Annie, in the studio.
KFAI is seeking new voices to help fulfill our mission of providing news and information to Minnesota's diverse communities. Paid translation opportunities are available for those who can speak and translate Spanish, Hmong, Somali, Amharic, Oromo, Tigrinya, and other languages you hear on the station. Send an email to hello@kfai.org. Or call the station during weekday business hours at 612-341-3144, extension 22, to get involved and help KFAI better reach our neighbors in the Twin Cities.
Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Health, reminding you to wear a cloth mask or a face covering when you will be around others. You may be transmitting the disease without knowing it, because you can do so without you yourself having any symptoms. Be sure the mask completely covers your nose and your mouth. For more information about protecting yourself and others from COVID-19, listen to KFAI on Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. for the special edition of Minnesota Native News, COVID-19 Community Conversations.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie, and this is your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. This Wednesday, August 25th, from 1 to 2 p.m., the American Swedish Institute presents Neil Price discussing his children's book, Of Ash and Elm, A History of the Vikings. On Wednesday, August 26th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., Subtext Books and John Palmer present a virtual event for his new memoir, Master of Deception. On Wednesday, August 26th, 7 to 8 p.m., Books and Bars discusses Educated by Tara Westover. I really enjoyed that one. So even if you can't make it to the Books and Bars tomorrow, can't recommend the book enough. Wednesday, August 26th, from 7 to 8, that's really when things are happening. Tomorrow evening, the wonderful Next Chapter Booksellers in St. Paul presents a virtual event with Caroline Hallbrook for her book of essays, Tell Me Your Names and I Will Testify. Thursday, August 27th, from 7 to 8 p.m., Majors and Quinn and Martin Shaw present a digital event for Cinderbiter, Celtic Poems. Saturday, August 29th, 2020, is Independent Bookstore Day. Check the websites of your favorite independent bookstores for more information. And now we'll be turning live on the air to another interview with our wonderful Dave Fettig.
Yeah, and I'm with Richard Terrell. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Richard?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Richard is the author of What Falls Away Is Always, Poems and Conversations, just out from Holy Cow Press. Very exciting. We'll have a reading from Richard in a little bit, but before we do that, let's warm up a little bit, Richard, okay? And let people get to know you a little bit. This is not your first book. You have a successful career. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
So let's start with the title. On two counts. The title proper, What Falls Away Is Always. The notes in the book tell us where it comes from, but I think it would be a nice little setup for readers. And then I want to ask you about the subtitle, Poems and Conversations. what you mean by that, and maybe you can give a sense for the work when we get to that point. But let's start with what falls away is always.
Well, that may be the toughest question of the whole interview. titles are always hard for me, and I burned through several, including one. I'm not going to tell you what it was, but I mean, I really liked it. And then once the Me Too movement came along, the title that I had almost seemed to be riffing on the Me Too movement, so I had to change that. I think there's the title is borrowed from a famous poem by Theodore Rethke, The Waking. His line is, what falls away is always and is near. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. And I guess the book, and maybe I can just morph into the subtitle, Poems and Conversations. What I'm doing in this book is having conversations with other texts, other poets, other poems, but also musicians, composers, jazz musicians, painters, artists, and people who are in the popular culture of the past. And so the book most of the poems are these conversations where I borrow something from another source. So it seemed right to me to borrow a title from another source. And I guess the sort of melancholy nature of that title seemed to my mind to fit tonally with a lot of the poems in the book.
Fantastic. So you know what? Let's get into a reading, Richard, right away. Because that's a beautiful description of the book. I loved encountering your titles, your quotes from musicians and other writers. They become the title of the poem. And especially as a person of a certain age, I knew a lot of the musicians you were referring to, and it was a real treat to read the conversation you were having with the musicians. So why don't you go ahead and give us an example of what you're talking about.
Okay. This one, I'm not borrowing a line, but it certainly has that, I guess, melancholy air about it. And this is a conversation with the future in the form of a letter to the future. It's about our current, I guess, environmental crisis. And it's called Dear Future. What you think of us will not be your first concern, just as you were not ours. You won't know we thought our diligence would be your salvation, that we looked out at the trees and they just stood there. We each cast a single shadow, longer at twilight, yes, but soon we couldn't recognize darkness. Each pin in the map stood for 10,000, and there were tens of thousands of pins. So we made more maps, but found the world wouldn't grow. Future, we knew so much for sure, there wasn't room for it all. Each mind was like a garage, so stuffed with belongings that cars had to park on the streets. Soon there was simply not enough dignity to go around, or fresh water, which became the same thing. The very air was like birdsong we thought we could identify, but the birds knew it not at all, so didn't sing. They couldn't fly any further south than this. We thought we could change the subject, that there were kingdoms yet to come. We held truth to be self-evident, but it proved to be disguised, difficult to tease out from our habits and necessities, which became an embarrassment of exceptions. The moon itself could be populated, couldn't it? The stars bore out our cold abstractions. Down the pipe, always another pagan invention. Each meadow, a place on which nothing was built yet. People grew sadder for what seemed like a long time, and then they got mad. Future, perhaps you know. They had come to believe in pure mind until matter put a cruel end to that short semester. They never thought that if the wolves roamed too close to the door, their houses had been built too close to the forest. Future, you became our article of faith, a proper name legally changed to rhyme with ours. If tomorrow, as I write, is the beginning of you, the atoms of the days and years between us may change slowly enough, like failing light, that you will even think you remember gardens.
No, thank you, Richard. Wonderful, wonderful choice.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, sort of a little apocalypse in that poem.
Exactly, exactly. I want to talk about your relationship with music, if we could.
Okay.
You seem like a musician. What, from reading this, and if you're not, you're pretty attuned to it.
I play jazz saxophone, and I have my whole life. I've played for 40 of the last 50 some years. I work mostly with the Larry McDonough Quartet in and around the Twin Cities. And maybe this is a chance to plug my book launch on Sunday, September 13th. And the band's going to play. So we're going to have music and then I'll read some poems. And through the miracle of technology, I'm able to read a poem and play the saxophone at the same time.
Is this a live event, Richard, or is it going to be online?
Oh, it's going to be on Facebook Live.
Okay.
And on my webpage or my Facebook page, which is Richard Terrill. You know, there are other, it's Terrill.
Right.
I found there are a lot of Richard Terrills, but I'm the only one who's pictured playing a saxophone. So when you find that, it's the right one.
I tell you what, we're talking about business here on the air, but that's cool too. Send us a note when we get closer. We'll be sure, like Annie announced earlier, we'll get you up on our literary calendar, and we'll put that up for our listeners. Okay, so let's talk more about music. Writers often talk about music and how it informs their writing, and the words are like jazz on a page. Jazz is often, you know, equated with poetry and sometimes with prose.
Yes.
If your name is Toni Morrison, you get that blessing too. But tell me about the relationship between music and poetry for you.
Well, for me, poetry starts with the sound of the words. And I know I'm not the only one, the only writer, much less poet, to feel that way. But what if I write one line, what drives writing the next line is the sound of the language. And, you know, I have strengths and weaknesses like any writer or any musician, but I think I have a pretty good ear. And I think that serves me well in poetry. Jazz is an improvisatory art form. When you play a solo, you don't have it planned out. You just go. And if you play something, then the next thing you play is determined by what you just played and by what the rest of the band has just played. So writing a poem or any writing really in its early drafts is improvisatory, like jazz. The difference, I think, is that with a jazz solo, you know, unless you're in the studio, once you play it, the notes disappear into time and space. But with writing, you're obliged to revise. And that's where the critical intelligence comes in. So I'd say, you know, two ways: that unwinding of ideas in improvisation and also the sound of language.
So do you then, when you're playing, think of words? Do lines ever come to you? And when you're writing, think of music?
No, not really. I guess the first I can say definitely no. I mean, it's hard enough to play a good solo, and you got to be listening to yourself and listening to the other people.
Right.
Am I in tune? You know, am I dragging? Am I rushing? And then, you know, I'm going to try to play this particular lick, and it maybe doesn't come out right. Well, sometimes you can take a mistake and make it into art. You know, if you let it wind out further. Poetry, I mean, I don't think of music, but you know, the rhythm and, you know, and the sound of words, the consonants, the vowels, the pitch of words is very musical. And it's important to read your poems aloud, to hear them. And that determines, that lets you make them better, I think, in revision.
Cool. How did you come to poetry? What came first for you in your life, music or poetry?
The music did. You know, like a lot of people of our generation, I started playing the horn when I was 12. You get to junior high, as we call it in those days, and they say, well, what do you want to play?
Right.
And I was lucky to pick the saxophone, which is the right instrument for me. I always liked to write. I think when I was about 9, I typed out a family newspaper every month and things like that. When I was in high school, I I started an underground newspaper. Those were the days. But it was, again, like I think a lot of poets, especially, but fiction writers too. I took a creative writing class in college, and mm-hmm. that's where I moved over from, you know, writing quasi-journalism to something creative.
There was a time when there were journals dedicated to poetry seemingly all over the place, right, Richard?
Yeah.
In the 70s and 80s and even into the early 90s before something called the internet came along, and now there's other ways to publish. I don't know what I'm going to ask here, but other than it was a rich time, and you could write some poems and get them published if you worked at it, right?
Yeah, you know, I think, I mean, I taught in an MFA program my whole career, most of my career at Minnesota State Mankato, and my students, now former students, would know more about online publishing probably than I do.
Sure.
But I think probably it's probably actually easier to publish a poem now, or to publish a short story or an essay. I also write essays. It's easier to publish now than it was back in the 70s and 80s with all those little magazines. But I think, you know, that there are so many magazines out there now online that, well, you know, it gets lost in the shuffle, but that's showbiz.
That's showbiz. That's right. I'd like to remind our wonderful listeners that they're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI. I'm Dave. The amazing Annie is in the studio, and I am speaking via Zoom with Richard Terrell, the author of What Falls Away Is Always, Poems and Conversations. Richard's a local, Minneapolis, I believe.
Yeah.
That's right. So congrats. We love our local writers. We really do. I want to talk about craft. I love to talk about craft with poets because it really feels like you're building something. And I like to start with form. So for me, when I read poetry, and I love to read poetry, first thing I encounter when I look at the poem is I see the shape of it. And that tells me something. It might tell me that, well, it's on the modern side, or, you know, there's some formal form to it, if you will, or lack of formality, or there's a shape, and that shape might say something about what the poem's trying to tell me. So it always begins with the way the words look on the page. So your different types of forms in this book are, they're all over the place, and that's fantastic. So here's the question on form from my blathering. Do you start with an idea of form, or does the poem and the words take you to a shape? And how important is that to you?
Well, it's very important, and your comments are very perceptive, both about this book and about poetry in general. You're right. I do have different shapes to the poems. So I would say that there's not a consistent answer to your question. Like, do I always say, okay, am I going to write this in long lines or short lines? And a lot of times poems will go through different incarnations where you might write it out as a prose poem, you know, without line breaks first. And then say, well, this isn't working, and then maybe I'll put it into stanzas. I do find that if I'm writing something, you know, and it's driven by sound and by content, if most of the stanzas seem to be about four lines, I try to make them all four lines.
Okay,
you get that consistency. Go ahead.
Do you back up then and start counting syllables and try to get things to beat the same way?
Yeah, that's I'm glad you reminded me. That's the other thing, place I wanted to go. Syllables sometimes, and for non-poets, you know, poets will, out there listening, poets will sometimes make all lines have the same number of syllables, particularly odd numbers like 7, 9, 11, because English is primarily an iambic language, and traditionally, you know, lines had maybe 10 syllables. Right. I go more by beats, by the stress. And I like to write a lot where I have it, or try to have, say, four beats to a line, or three beats, or some kind of pattern. And in the end, it may not be perfectly consistent, because finally, the poem has a mind of its own, and you can't force it into the form. But I think, probably because of my ear, and because I'm a musician, I listen more for beats than I do for counting syllables.
Sure, that's a great point. And then when you write a poem, for example, it might start with a few words, and then you hit the return a couple times, and a word is sort of falling way out to the right margin, like words are falling off a cliff. I mean, these are really expressive sort of ways of putting words, and it's very intentional.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so sometimes it's not the rhythm or the counting the syllables at all, but it is the way it looks on the page, as you say. And I have some poems where I do that as well. And you know, like one word will be way off to the side. Yeah. But that's when I do it mainly. It's humorous. It's mainly to be funny.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's have another reading, Richard, before we run out of time, because that always happens. And poems are meant to be read out loud, I think.
And yes. Yeah, and this is a perfect segue. It's almost as if you planned this, because the other one I plan to read has those words that are set off by themselves. And you know, I don't know if. In reading aloud, I can capture that, but maybe I'll try.
And we are in sync, Richard. We are in sync, my friend.
Okay, yeah. And you mentioned a lot of these poems, they take as their title a line from somebody else. And this line comes from the baseball pitcher, Dizzy Dean.
Oh, great. I love this poem.
In when I was a kid, and maybe, Dave, when you were a kid, he broadcast the Saturday Game of the Week on CBS. And he was from Missouri. He was a country boy, and he talked corny. And it wasn't a put on. He was really that way. And he was noted to have said at the end of a broadcast, "Fans don't fail to miss tomorrow's game." And he meant it straight. He didn't know what he had said. And I realize now that given that the Twins are playing, you know, without any people in the stands, this poem has become sort of prescient and timely. So it's called "Fans Don't Fail to Miss Tomorrow's Game," Dizzy Dean. "Otherwise, you may be in the stands alone. Since this broadcast reaches a wide audience, if tomorrow comes as scheduled, no athletes will leave their caps on during an anthem that won't be played. The flag that won't be flying may lack both stars and stripes. It will be the opposite of extra innings, less than rain shortened. No zeros will be affixed to the center field scoreboard above the green ivy that will still grow in lovely entanglement with the afternoon sun. No promotions, no giveaways, but the overpriced hot dogs will be as good as free if you can find a vendor. The beer would flow past the seventh inning curfew if your thirst for it hadn't stayed away, like everyone else who listened to this broadcast, which reached a wide audience. Baseball, so much like life, bench warming at the end of the dugout, stealing signs, left stranded in scoring position, sacrifice, optioned to AAA, long periods of inaction, broken by drama that's usually unproductive. Baseball so much like life that for tomorrow's game, you even know the final score."
I love it. Thank you, Richard. And for listeners at home or wherever you are, speaking of form, we have words like alone and away floating out there on their own. We have the word long stretched out. We have drama set up with exclamation marks and fun things like that. So thank you for that. I love that reading. I'm glad you chose that poem. I want to circle back to form again.
Okay.
Or craft. I mean, craft and craft. How you work. So, you know, are you one of these poets who gets divine inspiration and suddenly, you know, you got to hurry up and run down and grab a piece of paper and a pencil and get the words down? Or do you sit down every day with your coffee and get to work? How do you work?
Well, closer to the latter than the former. You know, poets who wait for inspiration, well, it's a long wait. The danger is, of course, that it doesn't come.
Of course.
A lot of writers do carry around, in the old days, a pocket notebook. I suppose people do it on their phones now. I don't do that, but I do, you know, I have a little scratch pad by the bedside and things like that around the house. That's more so I can sleep. You know, if I get an idea, I write it down because I forget everything because of my advanced age. So it's more draft after draft. And see, the thing is, I enjoy revision. To me, the first draft is the hard part because usually they're not too good. And the fun part is working on them, is putting them away, forgetting that you wrote them, and then look at them later as if you found them on a, you know, on a street corner or something. And then that's the fun part, is making the changes.
So writers listen to this show, and all writers like to talk about writing and how writing gets done. So you like to sit down at on a regular schedule and tease out memories, thoughts, ideas, and kind of play with them on a page?
Yeah. I don't know about regular schedule. I'm not very prolific, and I'm slow. It's been 10 years since my last book. You know, I can't wait 10 years for the next one. I'm too old. But so, and I have more time. I'm retired now from teaching, so the next one will come quicker. But especially revision, it's a pleasure to sit down. I think most writers learn that revision, writing is revision. The stuff you do at first is throat clearing.
Sure, of course. Right. I'd like to talk about a couple of poems. And first, I want to say I really like haiku poems. A lot of people sort of dismiss them as little fun 575 things, but I think they're really lovely and a nice discipline. And you have a poem there, page 41, haiku bumper stickers, which is so doggone clever. I wish I'd have thought of it myself, Richard, but you thought of it first and you wrote a lovely poem. But what I also noticed in there is the poem next to it, and an entirely different form, the villanelle, which is kind of fun. There's a thought in the haiku poem and the thought in the villanelle poem, and I'm going to read them out, and I'm going to have you talk about it, okay?
Okay.
Maybe we'll read some more of that, but if you allow me to do that.
Sure.
Okay. From the first poem called Haiku Bumper Stickers, near the end, a brief haiku here. Our lives don't really matter much, but we must live them as they do. And then the final line of the page of this poem next, the villanelle is hard to master, which is true. The last line of that is, never give up, screw it, life's a disaster. So do we have here Richard Terrell's worldview?
Well, you know, these are both comic poems. So, so our lives don't mean much, but we must live them as if they do.
I mean, that can be funny. That can be, you know, gloomy too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one thing I hope that unifies this book is this merging of the comic and the serious, because that's where I think art writing especially gets rich, is when you're funny and you're serious at the same time, that there's undercurrents. And so I said, never give up, screw it, life's a disaster. I think I'm riffing on sort of the don't ever give up kind of self-help, lines.
And it's a nice line at the end of that particular poem, because you address it right to the reader after you've been working through this, you know, lovely rhyme scheme, which is difficult, as you note, and I think you mean that in many ways. And then you directly address the reader. You do that often in these poems, maybe not often, but it's not uncommon for you to address the reader directly.
I'll have to go back and look. You're probably right.
Well, I hope so.
But in a way, you know, I mean, what's a poem but a conversation with a reader?
Right. That's true. I lost my track. No, that's fine, because we're nearing the end here. Well, I'll tell you what, maybe it'll come back to me. But before we get to the end, you mentioned again, Richard, if you would, your event coming up in September to kick off the book formally. Mm-hmm. And then talk to us about what else you might be working on, and maybe it's just the next book of poems. Go ahead.
Yeah. Again, it's Sunday, September 13th, 7 to 8 p.m. is the book launch. Facebook Live, my page, my name is Richard Terrill, T-E-R-R-I-L-L. Or if my website is richardterrill.com. There'll be a link on there. I'll be reading from the book, and also the Larry McDonough Quartet, of which I'm a member, longtime member, will be playing jazz. And I'll be reading some of the poems in the book that are about jazz and jazz musicians. And so we play a tune that's, you know, that fits with the poem. And then I read the poem at the same time. I thought it was very slick. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. Book is from holycowpress.org, and it's set subtext and next chapter in Moon Palace and St. Peter Arts Center. So
Fantastic. And I found the question I was going to ask you, and boy, we can talk about this one all night. So I'm sorry we got here at the end. We'll wait till Annie cuts us off. And that's your poem, The New Poetry. Yeah. And I was going to, I believe that's the name of it.
Yeah.
And I was going to talk to you about if that's a commentary on new poetry versus whatever you mean by old poetry, if that's a commentary about, you know, the evolution of poetry. Do you have particular views about this? What are you telling us here?
Yes, all of those things that I think readers of poetry may know. I'll try to make this quick, that I think there was sort of a shift in American poetry maybe 15 or 20 years ago to something lighter and a little prosier. Like sometimes the poems don't seem to make a lot of sense intentionally. And so so this was trying to be a comment on that and also maybe an example of it. But I think, you know, that any time that there are changes in any art form, the new is always looked at suspiciously by some, it's welcomed by others. So yeah, I was playing with that idea of how things change. So I'll just read the first few lines. The new poetry, you write it the way you sign someone else's name. You read it the way you read a menu in a foreign language you could be fluent in someday if you don't lose your appetite. So
yeah.
So I'm having fun with like somebody, you know, saying, God darn it, those new poets are messing things up for me.
Yes.
So that was that. I have one section of the book that collects all these lighter poems. And so I hope they bounce off of each other.
Fantastic. And that's just a reminder to me and to our listeners that these are really thoughtful poems. You put a lot into each one. And you, gentle listeners, chose to join us and not watch the Republican National Convention.
Hey.
Oh, you're amazing people. Now you can go back and watch it because the show has ended. I am Dave, and I am speaking with Richard Terrell, author of What Falls Away Is Always. And I'm going to turn it back to the amazing Annie in the studio. Thank you very much, Richard. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. I'm Annie, and you are listening to Write on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Richard Terrell and Paul Sturobin, plus our listeners who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Write on Radio at kfai.org/program/writeonradio. That's WRITE. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast. You can find on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere else podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.
The year was 1978. The top TV show was Laverne and Shirley. The best-selling car was the Oldsmobile Cutlass. The trendiest new food was the walnut and goat cheese salad. And the Twin Cities' newest radio station was KFAI. Laverne and Shirley lasted six more seasons. GM quit making Oldsmobiles in 2004. And when was the last time you ordered a walnut and goat cheese salad? But 42 years later, KFAI is still on the air. Our volunteers still produce the most eclectic radio you're going to find. And we're still listener-supported. We're still KFAI, community radio, radio without boundaries.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Health, reminding you to stay at least 6 feet from others when you go out and wear a cloth